I knew he wasn't dead before I was halfway back. I could hear him groaning and calling my name, begging me to help him get out. I don't know if the Jolanders or the Langhills or the Karens would have heard him if they'd been home or not. I decided it was best not to wonder. I had plenty of problems without taking that on. I had to figure out what to do with him. That was the biggest thing. But I couldn't seem to get far. Every time I tried to think of an answer, this voice inside started howling at me. "It ain't fair," that voice yelled. "This wa'n't in the deal. He's supposed to be dead, goddammit. Dead." "Help! Dolores!" His voice come drifting up. It had a flat, echoey sound, as if he was yelling inside a cave. I turned on the light and tried to look down, but I couldn't. The hole in the well cap was too far out in the middle, and all the flashlight showed me was the top of the shaft, big granite rocks with moss growing all over them. The moss looked black and poisonous in the flashlight beam. Joe seen the light. "Dolores," he calls up. "For God's sake, help me. I'm all broken." He sounded broken, too, his voice all bubbly and choked. Now he was the one who sounded like he was talking through a throat full of mud. I wouldn't answer him. I felt like if I had to talk to him, I'd go crazy for sure. Instead, I put the flashlight aside, reached out as far as I could, and managed to get hold of one of the boards he'd broken through. I pulled on it, and it snapped off as easy as a rotted tooth. "Dolores!" he yelled when he heard that. "Oh, God! Oh, God, be thanked!" I didn't answer. Just broke off another board, and another, and another. By then I could see that the day had started to brighten again, and birds were singing the way they do in the summer when the sun comes up. Yet the sky was still a lot darker than it had any business being at that hour. The stars had gone in again, but the flicker flies were still circling around. Meantime, I went on breaking off boards, working my way toward the side of the well I was kneeling on.
"Dolores!"
His voice come drifting up.
"You can have the money. All of it. And I'll never touch Selena again. I swear before God Almighty and all the angels I won't. Please, honey, just help me get out of this hole."
I got up the last board. I had to yank it out of the blackberry creepers to get it loose, and tossed it behind me. Then I shone the light down into the well. The first thing the beam struck was his upturned face, and I screamed. It was a little white circle with two big black holes in it. For a second or two, I thought he'd pushed stones into his eyes for some reason. Then he blinked, and it was just his eyes, after all, staring up at me. I thought of what they must have been seeing. Nothing but the dark shape of a woman's head behind a bright circle of light. He was on his knees, and there was blood all over his chin and neck and the front of his shirt. When he opened his mouth and screamed my name, more blood came pouring out. He'd broke most of his ribs when he fell, and they must have been sticking into his lungs on both sides like porcupine quills. I didn't know what to do. I kind of crouched there, feeling the heat come back into the day. On my neck and arms and legs I could feel it, and shining the light down on him. Then he raised his arms and kind of waved them, like he was drowning. And I couldn't stand it. I snapped off the light and drew back. I sat there, on the edge of the well, all huddled up in a little ball, holding my bloody knees and shivering.
"Please," he called up. "Please, and please."
And finally,
"Please, Dolores."
Oh, it was awful. More awful than anyone could imagine. And it went on like that for a long time. It went on until I thought it would drive me mad. The eclipse ended, and the birds stopped singing their good morning songs, and the flicker flies stopped circling. Or maybe it was just that I couldn't see them anymore. And out on the reach, I could hear boats tooting at each other like they do sometimes, shaving a haircut 2 bits mostly. And still, he wouldn't quit. Sometimes he'd beg and call me Honey Bunch. He'd tell me all the things he was going to do if I let him out of there, how he was going to change, how he was going to build us a new house and buy me the Buick I'd always wanted. Then he'd curse me and tell me how he was going to tie me to the wall and stick a hot poker up my snatch and watch me wiggle on it before he finally killed me. Once he asked if I'd throw down that bottle of scotch. Can you believe that? He wanted his goddamn bottle, and he cursed me and called me a dirty old used-up cunt when he seen I wasn't going to give it to him. At last it began to get dark again, really dark. So it must have been at least 8:30, maybe even 9 o'clock. I'd started listening for cars along East Lane again, but so far there was nothing. That was good, but I knew I couldn't expect my luck to hold forever. I snapped my head up off my chest sometime later and realized I'd dozed off. It couldn't have been for long, because there was still a little afterglow in the sky. But the fireflies were back, doing business as usual, and the owl had started its hooting again. It sounded a little more comfortable about it the second time around. I shifted my spot a little and had to grit my teeth at the pins and needles that started poking as soon as I moved. I'd been kneeling so long I was asleep from the knees down. I couldn't hear nothing from the well, though, and I started to hope that he was finally dead, that he'd slipped away while I'd been dozing. Then I heard little shuffling noises and groans and the sound of him crying. That was the worst, hearing him cry because moving around gave him so much pain. I braced myself on my left hand and shone the light down into the well again. It was hard as hell to make myself do that, especially now that it was almost completely dark. He'd managed to get to his feet somehow, and I could see the flashlight beam reflecting back at me from 3 or 4 wet spots around the work boots he was wearing. It made me think of the way I'd seen the eclipse in those busted pieces of tinted glass after he got tired of choking me and I fell on the porch. Looking down there, I finally understood what had happened, how he'd managed to fall 30 or 35 feet and only get bunged up bad instead of being killed outright. The well wasn't completely dry anymore, you see. It hadn't filled up again. If it had done that, I guess he would have drowned like a rat in a rain barrel. But the bottom was all wet and swampy. It had cushioned his fall a little, and it probably didn't hurt that he was drunk, either. He stood with his head down, swaying from side to side, with his hands pressed against the rock walls so he wouldn't fall over again. Then he looked up and saw me, and grinned. That grin struck a chill all the way through me, Andy, because it was the grin of a dead man. A dead man with blood all over his face and shirt. A dead man with what looked like stones pushed into his eyes. Then he started to climb the wall. I was looking right at it, and still I couldn't believe it. He jammed his fingers in between 2 of the big rocks sticking out of the side and yanked himself up until he could get one of his feet wedged in between 2 more. He rested there a minute, and then I seen one of his hands go groping up over his head again. It looked like a fat white bug. He found another rock to hold on to, set his grip, and brought his other hand up to join it. Then he pulled himself up again. When he stopped to rest the next time, he turned his bloody face up into the beam of my light, and I saw little bits of moss from the rock he was holding on to crumble down onto his cheeks and shoulders. He was still grinning. "Can I have another drink, Andy?" "No, not the beam. No more of that tonight. Just water'll do me fine from here on out." "Thanks. Thanks very much. Anyway, he was feeling around for his next hold when his feet slipped and he fell. There was a muddy squelching sound when he landed on his ass. He screamed and grabbed at his chest like they do on TV when they're supposed to be having heart attacks, and then his head fell forward on his chest. I couldn't stand any more. I stumbled my way out of the blackberry creepers and ran back to the house. I went into the bathroom and puked my guts. Then I went into the bedroom and lay down. I was shaking all over. And I kept thinking, what if he still ain't dead? What if he stays alive all night?
What if he stays alive for days, drinking the seep coming out from between the rocks or up through the mud? What if he keeps screaming for help until one of the Karens or Langles or Joe Landers hears him and calls Garrett Thibodeau? Or what if someone comes to the house tomorrow? One of his drinking buddies? Or someone wanting him to crew on their boat or fix an engine? And hears screams coming out of the blackberry patch. What then, Dolores? There was another voice that answered all those questions. I suppose it belonged to the inside eye, but to me it sounded a lot more like Vera Donovan than it did Dolores Claiborne. It sounded bright and dry and kiss my back cheeks if you don't like it. Of course he's dead, that voice said. And even if he isn't, he soon will be. He'll die of shock and exposure and punctured lungs. There are probably people who wouldn't believe a man could die of exposure on a July night, but they'd be people who've never spent a few hours 30 feet under the ground, sitting no more than 10 feet above dank island bedrock. I know none of that is pleasant to think of, Dolores, but at least it means you can quit your worrying. Sleep for a while, and when you go back out there, you'll see. I didn't know if that voice was making sense or not, but it seemed to be making sense. And I did try to go to sleep. I couldn't, though. Each time I'd drift a little, I'd think I could hear Joe stumbling his way up the side of the shed toward the back door. And every time the house creaked, I jumped. At last, I couldn't stand it anymore. I took off my dress, put on a pair of jeans and a sweater, locking the barn door after the horse had been stolen, I guess you'd say, and grabbed the flashlight off the bathroom floor from beside the commode where I dropped it when I knelt down to vomit. Then I went back out. It was darker than ever. I don't know if there was any kind of moon that night, but it wouldn't have mattered even if there was, because the clouds had rolled back in again. The closer I got to the blackberry tangle behind the shed, the heavier my feet got. By the time I could see the well cap again in the flashlight beam, it seemed like I couldn't hardly lift them at all. I did, though. I made myself walk right up to it. I stood there listening for almost 5 minutes, and there wasn't a sound but the crickets and the wind rattling through the blackberry bushes and an owl hooty-hooing someplace, probably the exact same one I'd heard before. Oh, and far off to the east, I could hear the waves striking the headland. Only that's a sound you get so used to on the island you don't hardly hear it at all. I stood there with Joe's flashlight in my hand, the beam aimed at the hole in the well cap, feeling greasy, sticky sweat creeping down all over my body, stinging in the cuts and digs the blackberry thorns had made. And I told myself to kneel down and look in the well. After all, wasn't that what I'd come out there to do? It was, but once I was actually out there, I couldn't do it. All I could do was tremble and make a high moaning sound in my throat. My heart wasn't really beating either, but only fluttering in my chest, like a hummingbird's wings. And then a white hand, all streaked with dirt and blood and moss, snaked right out of that well and grabbed my ankle. I dropped the flashlight. It fell in the bushes right at the edge of the well, which was lucky for me. If it had fallen into the well, I'd have been in deep shit indeed. But I wasn't thinking about the flashlight or my good luck, because the shit I was in right then was plenty deep enough. And the only thing I was thinking about was the hand on my ankle. The hand was dragging me toward the hole. That, and a line from the Bible. It clanged in my head like a big iron bell. I have digged a pit for mine enemies and am fallen into it myself. I screamed and tried to pull away, but Joe had me so tight it felt like his hand had been dipped in cement. My eyes had adjusted to the dark enough so I could see him even with the flashlight beam shining off in the wrong direction. He'd almost managed to climb out of the well after all. God knows how many times he must have fallen back, but in the end he got almost to the top. I think he probably would have made it all the way out if I hadn't come back when I did. His head was no more than 2 feet below what was left of the board cap. He was still grinning. His lower plate was stuck out of his mouth a little. I can still see that as clear as I see you sitting across from me right now, Andy. And it looked like a horse's teeth when it grins at you. Some of them looked black with the blood that was on them. Dolores! He panted and kept pulling me.
I screamed and fell down on my backside and went sliding toward that damned hole in the ground. I could hear the blackberry thorns ticking and snicking as my jeans went sliding past them and over them.
"Dolores, you bitch,"
he says. But by then it was more like he was singing to me. I remember thinking, pretty soon he'll start in on Moonlight Cocktail. I grabbed at the bushes and got my hands full of stickers and fresh blood. I kicked at his head with a foot he didn't have hold of, but it was just a little too low to hit. I parted his hair with the heel of my sneaker a couple of times, but that was just about all.
"Come on, Dolores,"
he said, like he wanted to take me out for an ice cream soda, or maybe dancing to the country and western over at Fudgy's. My ass fetched up against one of the boards still left on the side of the well, and I knew if I didn't do something right away, we were going to go tumbling down together, and there we'd stay, probably wrapped in each other's arms. And when we was found, there'd be people, ninnies, like Yvette Anderson for the most part, who'd say it just went to show how much we loved each other. That did it. I found a little extra strength and give one last tug backward. He almost held on, but then his hand slipped off. My sneaker must have hit him in the face. He screamed. His hand beat at the end of my foot a couple of times, and then it was gone for good. I waited to hear him go tumbling to the bottom. But he didn't. The son of a bitch never gave up. If he'd lived the same way he died, I don't know that we'd ever have had any problems, him and me. I got up on my knees and saw him go swaying backward over the hole, but somehow he held on. He looked up at me, shook a bloody clump of hair out of his eyes, and grinned. Then his hand come up out of the well again and grabbed onto the ground.
"Dolores!"
he kind of groaned.
"Dolores! Dolores! Dolores!"
And then he started to climb out. "Brain him, you ninny," Vera Donovan said then. Not in my head, like the voice of the little girl I seen earlier. Do you understand what I'm saying? I heard that voice just like you three are hearing me now. And if Nancy Bannister's tape recorder had been out there, you could have played that voice back over and over and over again. I know that as well as I know my own name. Anyway, I grabbed one of the stones set into the ground at the edge of the well. He kind of clutched at my wrist, but I pulled the stone free before he could set his grip. It was a big stone, all crusted with dry moss. I raised it over my head. He looked up at it. His head was out of the hole by then, and it looked like his eyes were standing out on stalks. I brought the rock down on him with all my strength. I heard that lower plate of his bust. It sounded like when you drop a china plate on a brick hearth. And then he was gone, tumbling back down the well, and the rock went with him. I fainted then. I don't remember fainting, just laying back and looking up at the sky. There was nothing to see because of the clouds, so I closed my eyes. Only when I opened them, the sky was full of stars again. It took me a little while to realize what had happened, that I'd fainted and the clouds had blown away while I was passed out. The flashlight was still laying in the brambles beside the well, and the beam was still nice and bright. I picked it up and shone it down into the well. Joe was laying at the bottom, his head cocked over on one shoulder, his hands in his lap and his legs splayed out. The rock I'd brained him with was laying between them. I held the light on him for 5 minutes, waiting to see if he'd move, but he never. Then I got up and made my way back to the house. I had to stop twice when the world went foggy on me, but I finally made it. I walked into the bedroom, taking off my clothes as I went, and leaving them just wherever they fell. I got into the shower and only stood there under spray as hot as I could take it for the next 10 minutes or so, not soaping myself, not washing my hair, not doing nothing but standing with my face up so the water had hit all over it. I think I might have fallen asleep right there in the shower, except the water started to cool off. I washed my hair quick before it could go all the way to stone cold and got out. My arms and legs were all scratched up, and my throat still hurt like hell. But I didn't think I was going to die from none of that. It never occurred to me what somebody might make of all those scratches, not to mention the bruises on my throat, after Joe was found down the well. Not then, at least. I pulled my nightgown on and fell on the bed and went fast asleep with the light on. I woke up screaming less than an hour later with Joe's hand on my ankle. I had a moment of relief when I realized it was only a dream. But then I thought, what if he's climbing the side of the well again? I knew he wasn't. I'd finished him for good when I hit him with that rock and he fell down the second time. But part of me was sure he was, and that he'd be out in another minute or so. Once he was, he'd come for me. I tried to lie there and wait it out, but I couldn't. That picture of him climbing up the side of the well just kept getting clearer and clearer, and my heart was beating so hard it felt like it might explode. Finally, I put on my sneakers, grabbed the flashlight again, and went running out there in my nightgown. I crawled to the edge of the well that time. I couldn't make myself walk, not for nothing. I was too afraid of his white hand snaking up out of the dark and grabbing onto me. At last I shone the light down. He was laying there, just the same as he had been, with his hands in his lap and his head cocked to one side. The rock was still laying in the same place between his spread legs. I looked for a long time, and when I went back to the house that time, I'd begun to know he was really dead. I crawled into bed, turned off the lamp, and pretty soon I cocked off to sleep. The last thing I remember thinking was, I'll be all right now. But I wasn't. I woke up a couple of hours later, sure I could hear someone in the kitchen. Sure I could hear Joe in the kitchen. I tried to jump out of bed and my feet tangled in the blankets, and I fell on the floor. I got up and started feeling around for the switch on the lamp. Sure, I'd feel his hands slide around my throat before I could find it. That didn't happen, of course. I turned on the light and went through the whole house. It was empty. Then I put on my sneakers and grabbed the flashlight and ran back out to the well. Joe was still laying on the bottom, with his hands in his lap and his head on his shoulder. I had to look at him a long time, though, before I could convince myself it was laying on the same shoulder. And once, I thought I saw his foot move, although that was most likely just a shadow moving. There were lots of those, because the hand holding the flashlight wasn't none too steady, let me tell you. As I crouched there with my hair tied back and probably looking like the lady on the white rock labels, the funniest urge come over me. I felt like just letting myself lean forward on my knees until I tumbled into the well. They'd find me with him. Not the ideal way to finish up, as far as I was concerned, but at least I wouldn't be found with his arms wrapped around me, and I wouldn't have to keep waking up with the idea he was in the room with me, or feeling I had to run back out with the light to check and make sure he was still dead. Then Vera's voice spoke up again. Only this time it was in my head. I know that, just like I know that it spoke right into my ear the first time. The only place you're going to tumble into is your own bed, that voice told me. Get some sleep, and when you wake up, the eclipse really will be over. You'll be surprised how much better things will look with the sun out. That sounded like good advice, and I set out to follow it. I locked both doors to the outside, though, and before I actually got into bed, I did something I ain't never done before, or since, propped a chair underneath the doorknob. I'm ashamed to admit that. My cheeks feel all hot, so I guess I'm blushing, but it must have helped, because I was asleep the second my head hit the pillow. When I opened my eyes the next time, full daylight was streaming in through the window. Vera had told me to take the day off. She said Gail Levesque could oversee putting the house to rights after the big party she'd been planning for the night of the 20th, and I was some glad. I got up and took another shower and then got dressed. It took me half an hour to do all those things 'cause I was so lamed up. It was my back, mostly. It's been my weak point ever since the night Joe hit me in the kidneys with that stove length. And I'm pretty sure I strained it again, first pulling that rock I clouted him with free of the earth, and then heisting it up over my head the way I did. Whatever it was, I can tell you it hurt a bitch. Once I finally had my clothes on, I sat down at the kitchen table in the bright sunshine and drank a cup of black coffee and thought of the things I ought to do. There wasn't many, even though nothing had gone just the way I'd meant for it to go. But they'd have to be done right. If I forgot something or overlooked something, I'd go to prison. Joe St. George wa'n't much loved on Little Tall, and there weren't many who'd have blamed me for what I did. But they don't pin a medal on you and give you a parade for killing a man, no matter if he was a worthless piece of shit. I poured myself a fresh slug of mud and went out on the back porch to drink it, and to cast my eye around. Both reflector boxes and one of the viewers were back in the grocery sack Vera'd given me. The pieces of the other viewer were laying right where they'd been since Joe jumped up sudden and it slid out of his lap and broke on the porch floor. I thought for a while about whether or not to clean up those pieces of glass. Finally, I went inside, got the broom and the dustpan, and swept them up. I decided that being the way I am and so many folks on the island knowing the way I am, it'd be more suspicious if I left them laying. I'd started off with the idea of saying I'd never seen Joe at all that afternoon. I thought I'd tell folks he'd been gone when I got home from Vera's, without so much as a note left behind to say where he'd taken his country butt off to, and that I'd poured that bottle of expensive Scotch whiskey out on the ground 'cause I was mad at him. If they did tests that showed he was drunk when he fell into the well, it wouldn't bother me none. Joe could have gotten booze lots of places, including under our own kitchen sink. One look into the mirror convinced me that wouldn't do. If Joe hadn't been home to put those bruises on my neck, then they'd want to know who had put 'em there. And what was I going to say? Santa Claus did it? Luckily, I'd left myself an out. I'd told Vera that if Joe started acting out the tartar, probably I'd leave him to stew in his own sauce and watch the eclipse from East Head. I hadn't had any plan in mind when I said those words, but I blessed 'em now. East Head itself wouldn't do. There'd been people there, and they'd know I hadn't been with 'em. But Russian Meadows on the way to East Head, and it's got a good western view, and there hadn't been nobody at all there. I'd seen that for myself from my seat on the porch, and again while I was washing up our dishes. The only real question... What, Frank? Oh, I weren't worried a bit about his truck being at the house. He had a string of 3 or 4 DWIs right close together back in 59, you see, and finally lost his driver's license for a month. Edgar Sherrick, who was our constable back then, came around and told him he could drink until the cows came home if that was what he wanted, but the next time he got caught drinking and driving, Edgar'd hoe him into district court and try to get his driver's license lifted for a year. Edgar and his wife lost a little girl to a drunk driver back in 1948 or 49, and although he was an easy-going man about other things, he was death on drunks behind the wheel. Joe knew it, and he quit driving if he'd had more than 2 drinks right after him and Edgar had their little talk on our porch. No, when I came back from Russian Meadow and found Joe gone, I thought one of his friends must have come by and taken him someplace to celebrate Eclipse Day. That was the story I meant to tell. What I started to say was the only real question I had was what to do about the whiskey bottle. People knew I'd been buying him his drink just lately, but that was all right. I knew they thought I'd been doing it so he'd lay off hitting me. But where would that bottle have ended up if the story I was making up had been a true story? It might not matter, but then again it might. When you've done a murder, you never know what may come back to haunt you later on. It's the best reason I know not to do it. I'd been so much as a sip of whiskey left in that bottle. It had to go down the well with him. And that's where it did go, all but the cap, that was. That I dropped into the swill on top of the little pile of broken tinted glass. I walked out to the well with the last of the scotch swishing in the bottle, thinking, he put the old booze to him, and that was all right. That was no more'n what I expected. But then he kind of mistook my neck for a pump handle. and that wa'n't all right. So I took my reflector box and went up to Russian Meadow by myself, cursing the impulse that made me stop and buy him that bottle of Johnny Walker in the first place. When I got back, he was gone. I didn't know where or who with, and I didn't care. I just cleared up his mess and hoped he'd be in better frame of mind when he got back. I thought that sounded meek enough, and that it'd pass muster. I guess what I mostly disliked about that goddamn bottle was getting rid of it meant going back out there and looking at Joe again. Still, my likes and dislikes didn't make a whole lot of difference by then. I was worried about the state the blackberry bushes might be in, but they wasn't trampled down as bad as I'd been afraid they might be, and some were springing back already. I figured they'd look pretty much like always by the time I reported Joe missing. I'd hoped the well wouldn't look quite so scary in broad daylight, but it did. The hole in the middle of the cap looked even creepier. It didn't look so much like an eye with some of the boards pulled back, but not even that helped. Instead of an eye, it looked like an empty socket, where something had finally rotted so bad it had fallen completely out, and I could smell that dank, coppery smell. It made me think of the girl I'd glimpsed in my mind, and I wondered how she was doing on the morning after. I had an idea she probably had her own covering up to do. I wanted to turn around and go back to the house, but I marched right up to the well instead, without so much as a single dragged foot. I wanted to get the next part behind me as soon as I could and not look back. What I had to do from then on out, Andy, was to think about my kids and keep faced front no matter what. I scooched down and looked in. Joe was still laying there with his hands in his lap and his head cocked over on one shoulder. There was bugs running around on his face. And it was seeing those that made me know once and for good that he really was dead. I held the bottle out with a hanky wrapped around the neck. It wasn't a question of fingerprints. I just didn't want to touch it. And dropped it. It landed in the mud beside him, but didn't break. The bugs scattered, though. They ran down his neck and into the collar of his shirt. I never forget that. I was getting up to leave. The sight of those bugs diving for cover had left me feeling pukey again. When my eye fixed on the jumble of boards I'd pulled up so I could get a look at him that first time, it wasn't no good leaving him there. They'd raise all sorts of questions if I did. I thought about him for a little while, and then, when I realized the morning was slipping away on me, and somebody might drop by any time to talk about either the eclipse or Vera's big doings, I said to hell with it and threw him down the well. Then I went back to the house, worked my way back to the house, I should say, because there were pieces of my dress and slip hanging from a good many thorns, and I picked off as many as I could. Later on that day, I went back and picked off the three or four I missed the first time. There were little bits of fluff from Joe's flannel shirt, too, but I left those. Let Garrett Thibodeau make anything of him he can, I thought. Let anyone make anything of him they can. It's going to look like he got drunk and fell down the well no matter what. And with the reputation Joe's got around here, whatever they decide on will most likely go in my favor. Those little pieces of cloth didn't go in the swill with the broken glass and the Johnny Walker cap, though. Those I threw in the ocean later on that day. I was across the dooryard and getting ready to climb the porch steps when a thought hit me. Joe had grabbed onto the piece of my slip that had been trailing out behind me. Suppose he still had a piece of it. Suppose it was clutched in one of the hands that was laying curled up in his lap at the bottom of the well. That stopped me cold. And cold's just what I mean. I stood there in the dooryard under that hot July sun, my back all prickles and feeling zero at the bone, as some poem I read in high school said. Then Vera spoke up inside my mind again. "Since you can't do anything about it, Dolores," she says, "I'd advise you to let it go." It seemed like pretty good advice, so I went on up the steps and back inside. I spent most of the morning walking around the house and out on the porch, looking for, well, I don't know, I don't know what I was looking for exactly. Maybe I was expecting that inside eye to happen on something else that needed to be done or taken care of, the way it had happened on that little pile of boards. If so, I didn't see anything. Around 11 o'clock, I took the next step, which was calling Gail Levesque up at Pinewood. I asked her what she thought of the eclipse and all, then asked how things were going over at her Nibs. "Well," she says, "I can't complain, since I haven't seen nobody but that older fellow with the bald head and the toothbrush mustache. Do you know the one I mean?" I said I did. "He come downstairs about 9:30, went out back in the garden, walking slow and kind of holding his head, but at least up, which is more than you can say for the rest of them. When Karen Jolander asked him if he'd like a glass of fresh squeezed orange juice, he ran over to the edge of the porch and puked in the petunias. You should have heard him, Dolores. Blech!" I laughed until I almost cried, and no laughter ever felt better to me. "They must have had quite a party when they got back from the ferry," Gail says. "If I had a nickel for every cigarette butt I've dumped this morning, just a nickel, mind you, I could buy a brand new Chevrolet. But I'll have the place spick and spiffy by the time Mrs. Donovan drags her hangover down the front stairs. You can count on that." "I know you will," I says. "And if you need any help, you know who to call, don't you?" Gail gave a laugh at that. "Never mind," she says. "You worked your fingers to the bone over the last week, and Mrs. Donovan knows it as well as I do. She don't want to see you before tomorrow morning, and neither do I." "All right," I says. And then I took a little pause. She'd be expecting me to say goodbye, and when I said something else instead, she'd pay particular mind to it, which was what I wanted. "You haven't seen Joe over there, have you?" I asked her. "Joe?" she says. "You're Joe?" "Yeah." "No, I've never seen him up here. Why do you ask?" "He didn't come home last night." "Oh, Dolores," she says, sounding horrified and interested at the same time. "Drinking?" "Course," I says. "Not that I'm really worried. This ain't the first time he stayed out all night howling at the moon. He'll turn up. Bad pennies always do." Then I hung up, feeling I'd done a pretty fair job planting the first seed. I made myself a toasted cheese sandwich for lunch, then couldn't eat it. The smell of the cheese and fried bread made my stomach feel all hot and sweaty. I took two aspirins instead and laid down. I didn't think I'd fall asleep, but I did. When I woke up, it was almost 4 o'clock, and time to plant a few more seeds. I called Joe's friends, those few that had phones, that is, and asked each one if they'd seen him. "He hadn't come home last night," I said, "and still weren't home, and I was starting to get worried." They all told me no, of course, and every one of them wanted to hear all the gory details, but the only one I said anything to was Tommy Anderson, probably because I knew Joe'd bragged to Tommy before about how he kept his woman in line, and poor simple Tommy had swallowed it. Even there, I was careful not to overdo it. I just said me and Joe'd had an argument, and Joe'd most likely gone off mad. I made a few more calls that evening, including a few to people I'd already called, and was happy to find that stories was already starting to spread. I didn't sleep very well that night. I had terrible dreams. One was about Joe. He was standing at the bottom of the well looking up at me with his white face and those dark circles above his nose that made him look like he'd pushed big lumps of coal into his eyes. He said he was lonely and kept begging me to jump down into the well with him and keep him company. The other one was worse, because it was about Selena. She was about 4 years old and wearing the pink dress her grandma Tricia bought her just before she died. Selena come up to me in the dooryard, and I saw she had my sewing scissors in her hand. I put out my hand for 'em, but she just shook her head. "It's my fault, and I'm the one who has to pay," she said. Then she raised the scissors to her face and cut off her own nose with 'em. Snip! It fell into the dirt between her little black patent leather shoes, and I woke up screaming. It was only 4 o'clock. But I was all done sleeping that night, and not too stupid to know it. At 7, I called Vera's again. This time her pet hunky answered, Kenopensky. I told him I knew Vera was expecting me that morning, but I couldn't come in, at least not till I found out where my husband was. I said he'd gone missing 2 nights, and 1 night out drunk had always been his limit before. Near the end of our talk, Vera herself picked up on the extension and asked me what was going on. I seem to have misplaced my husband, I said. She didn't say nothing for a few seconds, and I would have given a pie to know what she was thinking of. Then she spoke up and said that if she'd been in my place, misplacing Joe St. George wouldn't have bothered her at all. Well, I says, we've got 3 kids, and I've kind of got used to him. I'll be in later on if he turns up. That's fine, she says, and then, are you still there, Ted? Yes, Vera, says he. Well, go do something manly, she says. Pound something in or push something over, I don't care which. Yes, Vera, he repeats, and there was a little click on the line as he hung up. Vera was quiet for a couple of more seconds, just the same. Then she says, maybe he's had an accident, Dolores. Yes, I says, it wouldn't surprise me none. He's been drinking heavy the last few weeks, and when I tried to talk to him about the kid's money on the day of the eclipse, he damn near choked the life out of me. Oh, really? She says. Another couple of seconds went by, and then she said, good luck, Dolores. Thanks, I says. I may need it. If there's anything I can do, let me know. That's very kind, I told her. Not at all, she says back. I'd simply hate to lose you. It's hard to find help these days who doesn't sweep the dirt under the carpets. Not to mention help that can remember to put the welcome mats back down pointing in the right direction, I thought, but didn't say. I only thanked her and hung up. I gave it another half hour, then I rang Garrett Thibodeau. Wasn't nothing so fancy and modern as a police chief on Little Tall in those days. Garrett was the town constable. He took over the job when Edgar Sherrick had his stroke back in 1960. I told him Joe hadn't been home the last 2 nights, and I was getting worried. Garrett sounded pretty muzzy. I don't think he'd been up long enough to have gotten outside his first cup of coffee yet. But he said he'd contact the state police on the mainland and check with a few people on the island. I knew they'd be all the same people I'd already called, twice in some cases, but I didn't say so. Garrett finished by saying he was sure I'd see Joe by lunchtime. That's right, you old fart, I thought, hanging up. And pigs'll whistle. I guess that man did have brains enough to sing Yankee Doodle while he took a shit, but I doubt if he could have remembered all the words. It was a whole damned week before they found him, and I was half out of my mind before they did. Selina came back on Wednesday. I called her late Tuesday afternoon to say her father had gone missing, and it was starting to look serious. I asked her if she wanted to come home, and she said she did. Melissa Caron, Tanya's mother, you know, went and fetched her. I left the boys right where they were. Just dealing with Selina was enough for a start. She caught me out in my little vegetable garden on Thursday, still 2 days before they finally found Joe. And she says, Mama, tell me something. All right, dear, I says. I think I sounded calm enough, but I had a pretty good idea of what was coming. Oh, yes, indeed. Did you do anything to him? She asks. All of a sudden my dream come back to me. Selina at 4, in her pretty pink dress, raising up my sewing scissors and cutting off her own nose. And I thought, prayed, God, please help me lie to my daughter. Please, God, I'll never ask you for nothing again if you'll just help me lie to my daughter so she'll believe me and never doubt. No, I says. I was wearing my gardening gloves, but I took 'em off so I could put my bare hands on her shoulders. I looked her dead in the eye. No, Selina, I told her. He was drunk and ugly, and he choked me hard enough to leave these bruises on my neck, but I didn't do nothing to him. All I did was leave, and I did that because I was scared to stay. You can understand that, can't you? Understand and not blame me? You know what it's like, to be scared of him, don't you?" She nodded, but her eyes never left mine. They were a darker blue than I'd ever seen them, the color of the ocean just ahead of a squall line. In my mind's eye, I saw the blades of the scissors flashing, and her little button of a nose falling plop into the dust. And I'll tell you what I think. I think God granted half my prayer that day. It's how he usually answers them, I've noticed. No lie I told about Joe later was any better than the one I told Selina that hot July afternoon amongst the beans and cukes. But did she believe me? Believe me and never doubt? As much as I'd like to think the answer to that is yes, I can't. It was doubt that made her eyes so dark, then and ever after. "The worst I'm guilty of," I says, "is buying him a bottle of booze, of trying to bribe him to be nice when I should have known better." She looked at me a minute longer, then bent down and took hold of the bag of cucumbers I'd picked. "All right," she said. "I'll take these in the house for you." And that was all. We never spoke of it again, not before they found him and not after. She must have heard plenty of talk about me, both on the island and at school, but we never spoke of it again.